Today at Reader's Corner, former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, author of Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership in war and peace. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Leon Panetta's long service to our country is surely unique in the number of incredibly high-level and tough assignments he has held and held to acclaim. A lawyer, he has directed the U.S. Office for Civil Rights, represented his Central California district in Congress for 16 years, rising to the chairmanship of the Budget Committee, headed the Office of Management and Budget early in Bill Clinton's presidency, serving later as his chief of staff. President Obama brought Leon Panetta back to government, first as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency and later as Secretary of Defense. Secretary Panetta obviously never feared a challenge. Secretary Panetta and his wife Sylvia established and co-direct the Panetta Institute for Public Policy at Cal State Monterey Bay. Reflecting his ideals and personal example, the nonpartisan center seeks to attract thoughtful men and women to lives of public service and prepare them for the policy challenges of the future. I look forward to meeting Secretary Panetta when he is on our campus January 18th to receive the Frank and Bethine Church Award for Public Service at a dinner in his honor. But today he is on Reader's Corner to discuss his book, Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership in war and peace. He joins us today from the studios of KAZU at Cal State Monterey Bay. Secretary Panetta, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Bob, it's great to be with you.
Well, Secretary, you have had a remarkable career in the public service. In your book, you describe your upbringing, your father coming over here as an immigrant, all of the years you felt you paid back to this country, what the country had meant to you and your family. And now you and your wife, over the years, not just now, but over the years, have run the Panetta Institute for Public Policy. I'm fascinated by an April poll that you did of college students. And one of the findings in that poll, which is a little bit the reverse of what we normally hear about these millennials or these Generation Xers or Zs. Tell us a little bit about what you learned regarding our young people's commitment to the public service.
Well, it was a fascinating result. We've been taking polls of the attitudes of college students across the country for a number of years. The Institute now is in our 18th year. Normally, we try to stress a number of issues, looking at national issues, looking at candidates who may be running for office, getting attitudes in a number of areas. And one of the questions we've often asked is whether or not they would like to be part of a national service system in which they would serve in either a domestic or military capacity, and in return receive funds, obviously, for education and benefits for their career. And generally in the past, students have resisted that. They've indicated that that was not something they would be interested in. But we've continued to ask. And this last poll we took, we got an amazing result back, which was that 60% of the students said they would participate in a national service system that would require 1 or 2 years of service to the country, either in a civilian capacity or in a military capacity, and in return receive benefits for their education. And so it struck us as an interesting result and told us that, students obviously are interested in serving the country in some capacity. But more importantly, they're obviously interested in trying to get the benefits that would flow from that, particularly at a time when there's such huge debt at the college level.
As you and your wife and the Institute identify students who are interested in the public service, prepares them, and mentors them, and as you look back on your own career, any major differences in how you think we have to prepare young people for today's public service as opposed to the public service you entered in the 1960s?
Well, there is a big difference. When I got interested in public service, it's not just my parents who were urging me to get involved in giving something back to the country. It was also the 2 years of military service that I had where I learned about working together as a team to accomplish a mission and duty to country, but also a young president who said, ask not what your country has to do for you, but what you can do for your country. And that inspired me. I think public service at that time, and I was just coming out of law school, was really a higher calling and something that was attractive. And there were a lot of individuals, role models that you could look to in public service that inspired you to be involved and to get involved in our governing process. I think today, because of so much dysfunction in Washington and the gridlock between Republicans and Democrats, the inability to try to deal with major issues facing the country, a lot of students look at that situation like the rest of the country and are not attracted to it. And as a result, it's a much tougher sell to try to convince young people that it is important for them to get involved. It is important for them to be able to serve our country in some capacity, and that they can make a difference, that if young people do get involved, that they can bring different attitudes and different energy and a different approach to governing that would be important for the future. So I guess the reason we have great hope, and I see it in the students that go to the Panetta Institute, is that, you know, I see young people that aren't necessarily Democrats or Republicans, but really do want to do what's right for the country. And we have a number of programs. One, it's an interesting program, a congressional internship program, where we send students back to Washington to work in Washington for about 3 or 4 months to really see that situation. And, you know, we prepare them for what they're going to be in for and what they're going to see. But what I tell them is to always try to rise above it, to see the differences, obviously, in political ideology and the confrontation between Republicans and Democrats, but to understand that I came from a time when Washington worked, where Republicans and Democrats could, in fact, work together, find consensus on major issues, and be able to resolve these issues and govern the country. And that's what I want them to focus on, and I'm really excited that many of them understand the problems in Washington and do want to try to make a difference.
Well, to put it in your own words, if they're looking to doing what's right for the country, they certainly have the right leader in you and the offices and the positions you've held over your career in the service. I was fascinated in your book when you were talking about getting that call from President Obama to serve as CIA director. Share with us how you handled that phone call.
Well, you know, I spent my career in Washington obviously, as chair of the Budget Committee, working on budget issues, and then Bill Clinton, President Clinton, asked me to become OMB director, the Office of Management and Budget. So I worked on budget issues for the president, and you know, we were able to obviously pass a pretty significant budget that, you know, building on other agreements that were passed by the Congress, ultimately resulted in a balanced budget. And, you know, I'd done a lot there and then obviously became chief of staff to the president. I'd also, in the interim, when I came back to California, worked on ocean issues. I was chair of an ocean commission looking at the problems of our oceans. And so I figured, you know, when President Obama got elected, that, you know, there might be some interest in what I could do probably in that capacity, either on budget issues or ocean issues or natural resource issues. And so when I got the call and they asked if I would be interested in being CIA director, it was kind of, I thought maybe they had called the wrong person for that job. I said, while I was an intelligence officer when I was in the Army and had worked on intelligence issues, obviously, as chairman of the Budget Committee and also as chief of staff, that, you know, that was not something that I'd spent a lot of time on. And the president said he thought it was important that the credibility of that job needed to be restored. There was a lot of partisan differences with the CIA at that time, and that it was important to try to restore the credibility of our intelligence operations. And so that attracted me. I've always been attracted to challenging jobs, but I thought this would be a challenge because it involves, obviously, the war against al-Qaeda and terrorism, but also it was the challenge of trying to find bin Laden, who was involved, obviously, in the 9/11 attacks. So I thought there were a lot of interesting challenges in trying to take that job.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, author of Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership in war and peace. So tell us about the meeting with your staff, where you gathered them together to get more details about who's in charge of the hunt for Osama bin Laden. This strikes me as a great management 101 lesson. What did you learn?
Well, you know, I figured that this would be a big deal, that it would be something that, you know, the CIA would be heavily focused on. And they were. I mean, there were people that were working on this issue for a number of years, going back to 2001. And yet there was no kind of central task force that was involved in the hunt. And the challenge of trying to find bin Laden had kind of been dispersed over those years. So I said, who is primarily in charge here, you know, for finding bin Laden? And everybody started looking at each other. And, you know, I knew at that point that that's just not going to do it. And so what I did was to establish a task force, appointed individuals to head that task force, and required that they report to me every week on what they were doing to try to find bin Laden. And I told them, I said, when you come in and brief me, it is not acceptable to say we haven't been able to find anything. I said, you've got to come in, you've got to come up with ideas as to how we can try to locate bin Laden, and we've got to push as hard as we can, because this is an important issue to find the most wanted individual in the world because of what he was involved with in 9/11.
So you get to the point where you think you know where Osama bin Laden is hiding out, and the issue becomes not whether or not he's there necessarily, but just as importantly, how are we going to execute this mission? And at first I got the impression that there might have been an assumption on the part of some that this could be a CIA operation. But somewhere along the line, you had to make the decision that, no, this is probably going to have to go over to special ops. Help us out with how that decision unfolds.
Well, you know, we were able, you know, I describe in the book, to be able to finally determine the identity of bin Laden's couriers. And we were able to locate them in a town called Peshawar in Pakistan. And we were able to track them to this compound in Abbottabad, which is near the capital. And when we saw the compound, that's really when bells went off, because the compound was very unique. It was about three times the size of other compounds in the area. There were 18-foot walls on one side, 12-foot walls on another side, barbed wire around the tops of those walls. You know, there was very high security here. And as a matter of fact, the people involved would go 90 miles away from that compound in order to communicate. So it was clear they were implementing some very high security measures. And we continued the intelligence operation. And when the president said it was time to look at operations for how to go at this compound, you know, we looked at a number of different approaches. One was simply, frankly, to take a B-2 bomber and just blow the hell out of the place. But the problem was that would probably involve some collateral damage to some of the surrounding villages, and we didn't want to do that. We looked at other approaches, and finally we looked at commando raid as being something that would be probably the best approach. And you know, CIA has done operations in the past, but nowhere near the kind of operations that that the SEALs and other special forces had done. Special forces have been involved in these kinds of operations in Afghanistan and Iraq for a number of years, and we're doing a number of those kinds of operations in Afghanistan, where you helicopter into a target, you rappel down ropes, go after the target, and get the target and then get out of there. And so they had the unique training to do that. And so we kind of agreed at that point that it was important to ask Admiral McCraven, who was head of Special Forces, We wanted to brief him on what we had found and ask him for what would be the best approach to trying to go after this compound. It was not easy. I mean, as you can imagine, this is going after a target in Pakistan, 150 miles from Afghanistan. We'd have to go in at night, take two helicopters, bring two teams of SEALs to go in on that. We had at first talked about the possibility of working with the Pakistanis. Obviously, that would have made it a lot more convenient if we could have their support. But the problem was that in the past, when we had told the Pakistanis about potential targets, those targets were informed and soon escaped. And so we agreed that we could not trust them with that kind of information. So we knew we would have to do this alone and on our own. And that pretty much led us directly to the SEAL operation.
So when it was finally clear that the target was likely bin Laden, he'd been shot and killed, you had a walk across the White House lawn that really was a telling moment as to just what this meant to the country, what it meant to you professionally.
Yeah, you know, it was kind of amazing when, you know, we completed the mission and the SEALs had done their job. And reported it, obviously, to the White House, and then went down to the White House to meet with the President and National Security Council. And as I was walking into the White House, crowds were gathering around the White House, and they were yelling, USA, USA, CIA, CIA. And I thought, that's something I thought I'd never hear was you know, Americans gathering to pay tribute to the intelligence operation that had been involved in going after bin Laden. And it kind of gave me, you know, a special feeling inside that made me proud of the country, made me proud of the team that we had at the CIA, and particularly made me proud of the SEALs and the kind of courage and bravery and capability they brought to that operation.
Well, moving from what is obviously a most serious topic, one of the things that so impressed me about your book is the fact that the man, Leon Panetta, raised in California, was never really lost in all of these assignments. And he was still, to some extent, the ordinary guy that you might have a cup of coffee with in the morning. And I mentioned coffee because I was particularly fascinated and amused by your introduction to the coffee service in the CIA and thought that it highlights the fact that Leon Panetta may be the director of the CIA and then the Secretary of Defense, but he's still the guy that comes back home and acts like the rest of the guys at the coffee counter. Could you tell us what you experienced in that regard?
Well, you know, I think it's important in these jobs in Washington to protect your humanity. If you lose your humanity, and it's easy to do, Washington can be a really isolating experience. It can happen to presidents, can happen to leaders in the Congress who suddenly become isolated from the very people that elected you. You know, I'm the son of Italian immigrants, as I pointed out in the book. And I was raised to believe that if you work hard and you commit yourself to the things that you want to do, that you know, you can achieve those things and get a good sense of satisfaction. But in the end, it's really important to kind of understand who you are, to be honest with yourself, and frankly, to be honest with others. And so I took those principles to my job. And as a matter of fact, and I say this because we just lost a very good friend of ours, our dog Bravo. Bravo.
Sorry to hear that. I wanted you to tell that story.
Yeah, Bravo was, you know, just a Selby and I have said it. Sorry, he was our fourth son, and you get really attached. He was a golden retriever. And he always used to come to the office with us when we went to the Panetta Institute. And then when I got the job at CIA and Secretary of Defense, I actually brought Bravo back with me periodically. He'd come back and stay with me in Washington and go to the office with me. And I remember when I first brought Bravo to the CIA, you know, he got comfortable real fast, which was interesting. And we would be in these, you know, very classified briefings with these kind of grizzled CIA agents. Bravo would kind of walk around the table and nudge each of these guys for a quick pet on the head. And he could walk around, and they'd do it. And, you know, it just it was an amazing way to try to, you know, remember how human we are. And, you know, I've often said that he received some pretty classified briefings and never leaked a word as a result of that. And he did the same thing at the Defense Department. And as a matter of fact, when I had my portraits done, both at the CIA and as Secretary of Defense, I wanted Bravo to be in that picture because the employees all thought a lot about him. And when I spoke about it, I said, you know, what Bravo did was it reminded all of us, whether at the CIA or at the Defense Department, of our humanity. That's something I think that is really important for people to remember, that in the end, we are human beings, and we have to have the feelings and passions and the thought process of people that, you know, have to make tough decisions, but at the same time have to remember the kind of impact those decisions can have.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta about his memoir, Worthy Fights. Mr. Panetta is the recipient of this year's Frank and Bethine Church Award for Public Service, and he'll be honored at a dinner at Boise State on January 18th. The award is being presented in conjunction with the Frank Church Conference on Public Affairs, and you can find out more at boisestate.edu. Well, I don't want to leave this interview without your telling us one more little personal item, and it does go back to that coffee service, because you abolished the more formalized coffee service that the CIA provided, and you brought your own coffee cup in, and at least you have to share with our listeners that it was a CIA cup, but not exactly what they had in mind in CIA headquarters, because it stood for something a little different.
Yeah, no, we, you know, I said that would be nice to have some coffee in here. And of course, the CIA, you know, it tells you a lot about how they respond to directions of the director. So the next morning I walked in, and there was a kind of formal service of coffee. And, you know, it was all silver, and coffee cups were lined up. And I said, what the hell's this? And they said, well, you know, you got coffee. And I said, you know, I saw some coffee, you know, that was in a back room that the secretaries used for their coffee and others used for their coffee. I said, that's good enough. You know, I just need to be able to get a cup of coffee. I don't need to have a formal service. Besides that, they wanted to charge me for it. And I said, the hell with that, you know, as long as they got coffee in the back. So, you know, I was using a coffee cup, and then somebody gave me a coffee cup that had CIA on it. But it didn't stand for Central Intelligence Agency. It stood for California Italian Americans. So it was a cup that I continued to use throughout the time that I was at the CIA, and it kind of, again, it's something that reminds you you know, who you really are in these jobs, and that coffee cup in the morning was something that always reminded me of that.
So what's the greatest adjustment moving from the CIA to the Department of Defense? Obviously, numbers of people, for starters.
Well, I've often said it's a little bit like moving from the corner hardware store to one of these giant hardware operations that, you know, we have now. The CIA is a small number of people that are obviously involved in a lot of complicated missions. And you go to the Defense Department, and it's 3 million people, 2 million in uniform, 1 million civilians. It's huge. And I'm working in an office building that is the largest non-skyscraper building in the world, the Pentagon. And, you know, you suddenly look at the immensity of what you're responsible for and all of these bases and operations around the world. And it is, it's a huge, huge responsibility. But in many ways, you know, people often ask me, how do you take over these kinds of jobs? I think you have to apply the same kind of principles. I mean, at the CIA, it was very important to have the people there. And by the way, you know, the people that work at the CIA or, for that matter, at the Pentagon, they're not Republicans. They're not Democrats. They really are good Americans who are committed to the mission of those agencies and departments. And I had a lot of trust in their ability to do the job. But you have to establish a team. You've got to be able to bring them together as a team to have them trust you, and you have to trust them. You've got to build that kind of team relationship. You've got to set some clear goals, and you then have to go after those goals. So that's important to do. And so going to the Defense Department, I pretty much did the same thing. You know, actually, in all the jobs I've had, I thought it was important to have staff meetings every day, to bring your staff together first thing in the morning, to look at the issues that you're working with, to get their thoughts, to get their advice, so that you are all on the same page in terms of the mission that you've got to accomplish that day. And I did that at the Defense Department. And interestingly enough, they were not accustomed to having a staff meeting every day to talk through these issues. So I established that and had both civilians and military working with me in the morning. I'd go into that staff meeting, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs was there along with all of the civilian heads of the different sections. And I'd walk through, what are the key missions for that day, what we're dealing with on Capitol Hill, what we're dealing with in terms of the wars that we were involved with, what were the principal things that had to be done, listen to their views. And what that did was it pulled people together to operate as a team and then do their job. And frankly, that's the best way to try to operate, whether you're in a business or whether you're operating in a military unit or whether you're operating a department like the Defense Department. The most important thing is to make people feel like they're part of a team and that they trust your leadership and you trust them to do the job that needs to be done. And if you can build that kind of relationship, you can make it work.
Well, time has really flown by. I have time for one more question. And what I'd like to do is bring us up to issues of the current day. Not long before you stepped down as Secretary of Defense in 2013, you rescinded the rule that restricted women from serving in combat units, and you asked the military to assess what the issues might be in implementing that change. Your thoughts now that Secretary Ash Carter has opened up all positions in the military to women?
Well, women were very much a part of our military. I saw women who were pilots, who were out in the battlefield, women who died in battle, I attended many an Arlington service where we buried women soldiers, as a result of their bravery on the battlefield. And so I felt deeply that it didn't make a lot of sense to have these limits on the ability of women to actually be involved in combat or special forces positions. And my view was, and I think Secretary Carter has affirmed that women ought to be given a chance at these jobs. We ought not to lower the qualifications, and they're tough qualifications for the combat jobs, especially for special forces jobs. We ought not to lower those qualifications. But if there are women that can make those jobs and meet those qualifications, they deserve that chance. And that's all we're doing here, is giving them a chance to be able to participate. And I think that's good for our military. It opens up our military so that everybody can serve this country in any capacity that they qualify for. And that's what America is all about. I mean, I'm the son of immigrants. I had the chance to go to some of the highest jobs in Washington. If I can do that, others ought to have the same opportunity.
Secretary, thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Good questions, and I enjoyed it.
Leon Panetta, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. And a reminder to our listeners that Secretary Panetta will be visiting Boise State in conjunction with the Frank Church Conference on Public Affairs, which looks at Clash of Cultures, the Middle East in Turmoil. The conference and luncheon will be on Friday, January 15th, and the dinner honoring Secretary Panetta will be on the following Monday. You can get conference details and luncheon and dinner ticket information at boisestate.edu. Next week, Mary Pilon, author of The Monopolists, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.